members in northern Minnesota. Lake Country Power, energy that powers our lives.
Good morning. A few Senate Democrats voted with Republicans advancing a plan to end the longest shutdown in U.S. history. We'll hear from one of them, Senator Catherine Cortez Masto of Nevada, on this hour of Morning Edition from NPR News. The shutdown is not over yet, and neither is a fight over SNAP benefits. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Overnight, an appeals court said the administration must release funding that feeds the poor unless the administration appeals again. Also, the Mexican singer Juan Gabriel died in 2016, leaving behind decades of video he shot himself. It's Monday, November 10th. This day 50 years ago, a freighter, the Edmund Fitzgerald, sank during a storm in Lake Superior. It's been almost impossible ever since to grow up in the Midwest without hearing that song. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. A group of Senate Democrats and an independent broke ranks yesterday and voted with Senate Republicans to move forward with a short-term spending deal. It would reopen the federal government, closed now for 41 days. Most Democrats have been opposing a deal. They demand that Republicans extend subsidies for health insurance. Maine Independent Senator Angus King voted for the deal. He feels further delay won't get Republican senators to change their position on restoring the health care tax credits.
Would it change in a week or another week or after Thanksgiving or Christmas? And there's no evidence that it would.
The stopgap deal would fund the government through the end of January. Some agencies would get funding for a full year. Late last night, a federal appeals court ordered the Trump administration to restore full funding to the federal food assistance program known as SNAP. NPR's Tovia Smith reports the shutdown has held up the benefits.
A federal appeals court at midnight last night refused a Trump administration request to pause a lower court ruling, which means officials now have 2 days to pay SNAP benefits at 100%, not 65%, though they could take the case to the Supreme Court for the second time in a few days. A deal to reopen the government could get full payments flowing almost as quickly, but the SNAP lapse may have longer-term ramifications. Food pantries say they expect high demand to continue as many SNAP recipients need to restock their cupboards, and some food banks say they expect to be short on stock since some large food orders they usually get from the government were not processed during the shutdown. Tovia Smith, NPR News.
The federal government shutdown means air travel is still being slowed up to 10% by the end of this week. The tracking site FlightAware.com says more than 1,500 flights have been canceled in the U.S. so far today. Delays are being reported at major East Coast hubs. Millions of Americans are dealing with an early blast of wintry weather. As NPR's Matt Bloom reports, the National Weather Service says the cold snap will persist through the early part of this week.
Across the Great Lakes region, millions of people are seeing their first snowfall of the season. The winter weather has triggered advisories from Illinois to New York State and northern Maine. It's being driven by a large mass of Arctic air moving over a large swath of the country. Temperatures in dozens of states are expected to hover 10 to 15 degrees below average. Daily records could fall, especially in parts of the South. A freeze watch is in effect from central Georgia to the Carolinas from Monday night into Tuesday. Even parts of northern Florida are expected to see a winter-like frost. The weather should bounce back to average November temperatures by midweek. Matt Bloom, NPR News.
You're listening to NPR. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is meeting envoys from President Trump. They include Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, and Steve Witkoff. This comes as Hamas has handed over the remains of an Israeli soldier who was killed in action in Gaza in 2014. Israel has been handing over the remains of Palestinians. The exchanges are part of a ceasefire brokered by the U.S. President Trump is set to welcome the interim Syrian president to the White House today. Ahmed al-Sharaa helped lead the overthrow of Syrian dictator Bashar al-Assad nearly a year ago. Al-Sharaa is expected to urge Trump to repeal sanctions imposed on Syria while Assad's family controlled the country. Today marks the 50th anniversary of a Great Lakes maritime tragedy. NPR's Netta Ulaby reports 29 men died on November 10, 1975, during the wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald.
We remember the disaster because of the song by Gordon Lightfoot, but it was one of thousands suffered by crews transporting lumber, limestone, and other goods across Lake Superior.
The legend lives on from the Chippewa on down.
A new best-selling book by John U. Bacon called The Gales of November tells the stories of the sailors.
It wasn't just 29 men. It were people with lives and futures and hopes and dreams and people on shore who were always worried about them, looking for them to come home.
Safety standards have tightened since the wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald. No other freighters have sunk on the Great Lakes in the past 50 years. Netta Ulibi, NPR News.
This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Imaginable Futures, funding programs in the U.S. with the goal of ensuring young children and their parents get the education they need to thrive. Learn more at imaginablefutures.com. This is NPR.
I'm Heidi Holton. We're excited at KEXE to be bringing you more jazz programming with our volunteer, Paul Kivi, the history of jazz.
Well, I think this is some of the finest music ever made, and it's kind of gotten lost across time. I pick the songs that I love, and there's lots of them, and there's lots to love. The popular music in the late 20s and 30s, especially the 30s and 40s with the big band era, that was jazz. That was the one period of time when jazz was popular music. And so you're going to hear a lot of things that are easy to get into. If you develop a taste for it, then the stuff that happens starting with Charlie Parker in the late 1940s makes sense.
Hear the history of jazz on KAXE with Paul Kivi, Saturdays at noon and Sundays at 4.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Leila Faldin. Good morning. A group of Senate Democrats have defected to agree to a deal with Republicans to end the government shutdown.
In a few moments, we will speak with one of the Democratic senators who voted to reopen the government. This measure received 60 votes in the Senate last evening, exactly enough. John Thune, the Republican leader, is looking to work through Senate procedures in days to come.
I am optimistic that after almost 6 weeks of this shutdown, we'll finally be able to end it.
Most Democrats still voted no, saying the agreement gives them no assurance on their central demand, which was extending subsidies for health insurance.
NPR congressional correspondent Claudia Grisales has been following this and joins us now. Good morning, Claudia.
Good morning, Leila.
Okay, so for weeks we've seen fits and starts of talks, blame games, both sides dug in. Now this group of rank-and-file Senate Democrats is breaking with leadership to move this deal forward. What's actually in the agreement?
Well, the package includes a stopgap measure to fund the government through the end of January. It also includes full-year appropriations funding plans for some federal agencies and services. It will pause planned cuts to the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, also known as SNAP. It also reverses federal worker layoffs installed by the Trump administration during the shutdown and protects the workforce from more cuts for a few months to the end of January. Democrats who defected also got a promise of a vote on health care. As you remember, the party has fought a Republican stopgap measure to reopen the government to address expiring Affordable Care Act subsidies that spike premiums, but they didn't quite get there.
Okay, but that was the main demand, right? I mean, how did this group of Democrats get to yes if they didn't get their top demand to protect Affordable Care Act credits?
Right. They've been separately negotiating with Republicans for some time now. And they said that they could not get this deal from Republicans. They were pretty adamant. So the impacts and the chaos growing for federal agencies or workers, and then we saw flight delays and cancellations across the country. This also created new pressures for Democrats, these who defected. And the group also argued that growing numbers of people were being hurt, and the plan includes a long list of wins for their party. So in the end, 7 Democrats and 1 independent joined Republicans to get this plan across this key procedural hurdle.
But they broke with leadership, right? And most Democrats voted no. And what did the rest of the party say then about what they did?
Well, some were pretty furious. This defection came after an hours-long meeting for Senate Democrats, and Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer, who voted no, he argued that regardless of the outcome, Democrats have put a spotlight on health care.
We are going to fight legislatively, fight back home, fight in the courts, and bring this fight in the elections.
You could also say there's a political calculus here with Schumer and other leaders voting against this deal. They're hoping they're insulated from blowback from their party, but that remains to be seen. After Democrats left that meeting last night, I heard the angriest response from Democratic Senator Elizabeth Warren. She said this was a terrible mistake. And when she was asked if Schumer did a good job leading the caucus on this, she said, "I think the American people want us to stand and fight for health care. Obviously, that is not happening." So this was always going to be an ugly ending. Democrats could come out of this pretty bruised, but some would argue Republicans will not be left unscathed either.
So what happens next? When can travelers expect to see their flights resume and people's food benefits to be paid in full?
Well, the Senate still has a few more hurdles before final passage, but if that happens, the House will take it up in the coming days, and we could see those flights and food benefits get back to business in the coming week or so.
That's NPR Congressional Correspondent Claudia Grisanis. Thank you.
Thank you.
Democratic Senator Catherine Cortez Masto of Nevada was among 8 Democrats and independents who voted in favor of the deal to end the shutdown. She had, in fact, voted to open the government sooner. Senator, good morning.
Good morning.
What, if anything, did Democrats gain from the past 6 weeks of the government shutdown?
Well, let me just say a couple of things. One, and as you pointed out, I was one that have voted that we shouldn't have shut it down. But let me just say this. I can honestly say that the Democrats are united in this fight, which is a fight against the bad policies of this administration and to address the looming health care crisis that we have. You know, Jackie and I are fighting for Nevadans, and we have different tactics about doing it, but this is a fight to ensure that people have access to health care and can afford it. We are seeing people in our states, premiums are increasing already. And so there are many people that rely on this health care. I know families that need this health care because of children with rare diseases. And so it is important that we continue this fight. Mm-hmm. And let me just say this. Democrats are united that we need to get this done because we are seeing this in our states and all states across this country, including in Republican states. And if Republicans choose not to come to the table to address this issue, then they own the disastrous premium increases that this will bring. And they have to be responsible to their constituents why they are not addressing the affordability issue that is an issue in this state for many families and individuals.
You mentioned Jackie. Of course, you mean Jackie Rosen, your fellow Nevada senator who had been voting differently on this. It sounds like, though, based on your votes, you did feel that the Democrats picked the wrong tactic, the wrong fight.
No, listen, I'm not going to criticize my colleagues because we are all in this fight against the bad policies of this administration. Everybody's going to have a way of fighting in their states and showing that fight, and we have to. It's what this administration is doing with the tariffs and a failure to lack of address the affordability issue in this country is important. I see it in my state all the time, and this administration said on day one that they were going to address the cost and have done nothing. And I've got small businesses closing. I've got people that can't afford groceries at the grocery store or clothes for their kids when they get ready to go to school. And now we have a healthcare crisis that we could address simply by coming to the table and passing these subsidies. But the Republicans and this administration refuse to do so. And let me just be very clear
quickly.
Because these are the policies of this administration. They would rather harm people. They would rather make sure that people can't access SNAP programs and essential funding and food just to harm individuals to prove a point and play politics. That's not where the Democrats are here.
I want to acknowledge that in this battle, you've had an opportunity to raise these issues. It's created a lot of political conflict and a lot of news stories, and there's been a lot of discussions. So you did get that out of this. However, elsewhere in the program today, we spoke with Congressman Richie Torres of New York. He's in the House of Representatives. He is not at all in favor of this agreement. And I said, well, we're going to hear from Senator Cortez Masto, who's voting for it. What question would you have for her? And here's what he said.
I would ask, why does the deal fail to extend the tax credits for 24 million Americans? I mean, that was the whole objective that Democrats were pursuing. By that standard, it's not mission accomplished. It's mission failure.
Is he right?
Again, it goes back to this idea of where we think our tactics can be as still fighting for Americans. Let me counter that with this. Governor Spangberger just won, governor-elect in Virginia.
Right.
And she won on the issue of affordability. And she said the government needs to be open. And she focused on the affordability issue, not because the government was shut down. So we can still, and this is a misnomer, and I just have to say this so many times, we can have the government open, fight for people to make sure that our kids are not dragged into losing access to SNAP, essential SNAP funds and meals, or seniors lose their meals. We can make sure they have those and still fight on the affordability issue. And by the way, this is on the Republicans. We've got to vote in December.
Right.
To decide whether or not they're going to be with us to address this issue on the premium tax credit. Now they're going to own it. They can step up to the plate and help us address this issue for Americans across the country who are losing access to health care.
You've been talking with Republicans. You've been talking to Republicans. Do you think that any of them might vote with you in December?
We're going to find out. Let me say, we're going to find out. We will find out. Part of the agreement that we entered into, and you heard it, was Leader Thune said he would come to the table on a health care once the government was open. And now he's got to follow through. He gave us a December date, and now they've got to follow through. And the American public will see where, at the end of the day, Republicans lie. Do they really care about this issue, or do they want to cause more affordability issues?
I want to ask about the side issues that are part of this agreement. There are some appropriations bills that go through. There's a provision that furloughed workers will be paid, which under the law they already should have been paid. Fired workers will be rehired. Mass firings will not continue. These are the agreements. But it now goes to the administration, which has taken the view that any restriction on the president's power to fire people is unconstitutional and that they will ignore it. That has been their position in the past. Given that, is that part of the agreement worthless?
Well, that's like saying, Steve, then, because, and I agree with you, this administration is lawless and they ignore everything. But then that's like saying, then we shouldn't just do anything. Then we shouldn't do our jobs here. We shouldn't appropriate. We shouldn't come together to demand certain things in the appropriations bills or demand from our Republican colleagues any type of guarantee from them that they will stand united with us because the administration is not going to be there. Then we might as well just shut down and give them everything. So this is part of holding Congress's role here and our Republicans accountable. They've said that they're going to stand with us on these issues and fight for federal workers. And now they're we'll see if they stand true to that. They've got to be a part of the solution and be a backstop to this administration.
You think that the Republicans who are voting with you here will not only agree to these measures but actually try to do something if the administration ignores them?
I am telling you that what the Republicans have agreed to is just what you talked about, the RIFs and the reductions in force and to protect that workforce. If they go back on their word in this agreement, then the American public will know where the Republicans, who are control in Congress, where they stand. Do they really care about Americans at the end of the day and addressing the affordability issue and making sure people have jobs?
Senator Catherine Cortez Masto of Nevada, it's a pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Steve.
Have a good morning. This is NPR News.
19 minutes after 6 o'clock. Thanks for listening to the Monday Morning Show on KAXE. Good morning, I'm Jennifer Barr. Support comes from Edward Jones Financial Advisor Christina Gallas, helping individuals and business owners reach their financial goals. More information at edwardjones.com, Edward Jones, member SIPC. We also thank Atchison Tire in Grand Rapids, providing service and offering tire brands like Bridgestone, Firestone, and Toyo, serving the area since 1916. More at atchisontire.com. Weather today, partly sunny, highs in the mid-30s, and for tonight, mostly cloudy, lows in the mid-20s, and tomorrow, Veterans Day, partly sunny, highs in the low to mid-40s, with breezy south wind. Programming is supported in part by the Minnesota Humanities Center, distributing more than $6 million in cultural heritage grants. Funding is available to individuals and organizations that will create, celebrate, and teach Minnesota's diverse arts, culture, and heritage, including Indigenous organizations, historically underrepresented communities, and recent immigrants and veterans. Details at mnhum.org/grants. The KAXE News Team has put together a list of food-related resources across northern Minnesota. You can find hours of operation and locations of food shelves, plus information on soup kitchens and community meals. Find that at KAXE.org. And if you have something to add, email news@KAXE.org.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from AEG Presents, presenting Brandi Carlile's The Human Tour 2026, with stops across North America. Tickets are available now at brandycarlile.com. From AT&T, a network that is making connections for Americans. Connecting changes everything. Learn more at att.com/YATT. From Easy Cater, designed to help organizations order food for meetings and events from a nationwide network of restaurants, create lunch programs for their employees, and manage food spend at easycater.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm A. Martinez. Mexican singer-songwriter Juan Gabriel sold millions of records, wrote dozens of hit songs, and toured for decades to sold-out crowds. And for about 45 years until his death in 2016, he chronicled almost all of it using handheld video cameras and tape recorders. Those decades of footage are the foundation of a new documentary series on Netflix called Juan Gabriel, I Must, I Can, I Will, which revives the private and public life of the musical legend. I spoke with Maria Jose Cuevas, the director of the series, and this is how she describes Juan Gabriel.
He is a truly unique figure, not only for his talent, his music, and his compositions. We owe him not just for his music, but also for being a person who broke many stereotypes and prejudices. And my most cherished memory is attending his concert at the Palace of Fine Arts in 1990.
Wow.
It's iconic because it was the first time a popular singer performed on a stage traditionally reserved for ballet, opera, and classical music. Yet, he managed to get the entire audience at a venue where he wasn't initially accepted to get up and dance.
Tell us what Juan Gabriel means and meant to Mexico and Mexicans.
Yo no conozco a nadie que no quiera a Juan Gabriel. Entonces Juan Gabriel siento que es un símbolo.
I don't know anyone who doesn't love Juan Gabriel. I feel he's a musical icon, almost a national symbol. And that's despite the context in which he emerged. Mexico in the 1970s and 1980s, a deeply conservative, macho, and homophobic country. Then suddenly, this figure appears, someone who manages to win over every social class, every kind of audience, even the most macho man. He's both a great provocateur and a great conqueror.
His sexuality, Maria, was a big source of conversation and controversy throughout his career. There's a clip from Juan Gabriel from an interview about the controversy around him.
Pero desgraciadamente, aparte de ser un buen vendedor de discos,
Soy un magnífico vendedor de periódicos.
So he says, as good as he is at selling records, he is even better at selling newspapers. How did he handle this constant speculation about his love life? And did he actually really care?
Yo creo que justo era un momento, ¿no? En el mundo entero.
I think it was a time when artists all around the world simply weren't coming out of the closet. Freddie Mercury in England, Elton John. I mean, back then, if artists, singers, or celebrities came out in the 70s and 80s, it would very quickly have ended their careers. In a 2002 interview, Juan Gabriel was asked if he was gay, and he responded with this iconic phrase.
Dicen que lo que se ve no se pregunta, mijo.
What is seen doesn't need to be asked.
Y yo creo que él siempre se manejó así en su vida.
I think he always lived that way. He was essentially saying, this is who I am. Don't ask me. You can see it. And that's a form of provocation, a kind of quiet revolution about being yourself and always playing with that ambiguity.
So there was Juan Gabriel, the artist. That's his stage name. His real name was Alberto Aguilera Valadez. What would you say, Maria, is the biggest difference between Juan Gabriel and Alberto Aguilera Valadez?
Alberto es el compositor.
Alberto is the composer. He is the one who writes down all his experiences, who pours out his loneliness, who is the child forced to face solitude, and the man who seeks to fill all these voids by becoming a father. And I feel that Juan Gabriel is the performer who sings these songs of loneliness. But he is the one who becomes free. He creates a completely liberated persona to then fill all those voids for the audience. That is the difference.
One of the things, Maria, that I think this docuseries did very well is really illustrate the difference between the personal versus the public image. Mm-hmm. And it helped that we heard Juan Gabriel's voice throughout this whole thing. When did you decide that this documentary series would be that, would be told in that way?
Cuando tuvimos acceso a este tesoro, que es la bodega donde él mantenía todos sus cassettes.
When we gained access to this treasure trove, the storage room where he kept all his cassettes, we discovered that many of them had mold after having been stored there for so many years. The truly remarkable thing about this man is that, from a young age, Alberto Aguilera bought a Super 8 camera and developed a passion for documenting his entire life. Thanks to that vision, for 45 years, he filmed and stored everything that was Alberto and everything that was Juan Gabriel. For me, the experience was deeply immersive, constantly delving into this dual universe.
I want to know what your favorite Juan Gabriel song is. Mine is Querida.
Querida, cada momento de mi vida, yo pienso en ti más cada día.
When I was a little kid, my grandfather was a very serious, quiet, and strict, stern man. Mm-hmm. But there was one time where I saw him play this song, and he closed his eyes and was mouthing the lyrics to that song. I'd never seen that kind of emotion out of him. And it really made me think, man, that song has that much power over him. So for you, what is your number one Juan Gabriel song?
Híjoles, me gustan miles, pero
there are several that I like, but the one that comes to mind right now is Debo Hacerlo. It's a song that was also very present in the series. In fact, we took the title of the series, I Must, I Can, and I Will, from it.
Oh, yeah. Maria Jose Cuevas directed the docuseries Juan Gabriel, I Must, I Can, I Will. It is streaming right now on Netflix. Maria, muchísimas gracias por hacer esta entrevista conmigo.
Ay, muchísimas gracias. Thank you so, so much.
Debo hacerlo todo con amor.
This is NPR News.
Ireland's new president won by a landslide running on a far-left anti-establishment campaign.
She was kind of speaking to a lot of younger people in particular who wants the country to be different in terms of progressive values.
I'm Juana Summers, how Catherine Connolly won Ireland's presidency and what it can mean for the country's political landscape. That's on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Mm-hmm.
It is 6:39. Good morning. Thanks for listening to the Monday Morning Show on KAXC. You can hear All Things Considered coming up at 4 o'clock today with your local host, Andrew DeZingle. Coming up in a few moments, we're going to have Minnesota Native News with an interview with activist and chef Sean Sherman. And then Laura Erickson will be speaking for the birds. We're going to hear about a rare sighting of the cattle egret. Temperatures right now range from 22 in Hibbing to 26 in Brainerd and Aiken, currently 25 in Grand Rapids, 23 in Park Rapids and Bemidji. For today, we can expect a mix of clouds and sun with highs near 33, winds from the west 5 to 10. Chance of flurries tonight with lows 22 to 29, winds from the south gusting up to 20 miles per hour. And tomorrow, partly to mostly sunny, a bit warmer, highs 41 to 46, but blustery northwest winds. Our lows tomorrow night near 29, and looking ahead to Wednesday, sunny, highs in the low 40s and breezy northwest winds. For our question of the week, we were inspired by our What's for Breakfast guest on Friday. Kevin was telling us about his homemade denim vest that he made in home ec class instead of a gun case because he didn't have a gun. And we heard a few stories, and that's going to be our question of the week. We want to hear about those projects you did in school, whether it was home ec class, shop class, maybe another project. You can text in 218-326-1234. Support for KAXE comes from Happy Dancing Turtle, a nonprofit organization dedicated to growing stewards through education, programs, and experiences. More information at happydancingturtle.org. Here is Minnesota Native News.
Welcome to Minnesota Native News. I'm Marie Rock. This week, a special extended interview from a past segment. Travis Zimmerman interviews award-winning author, activist, and chef Sean Sherman about releasing a new cookbook this month and opening a new restaurant in spring of 2026.
My name is Sean Sherman. I am the executive director at NATIFS, which is North American Traditional Indigenous Food Systems in Minneapolis. NATIFS has the Indigenous Food Lab, which has the market space, a classroom studio, production kitchen. My restaurant, Awamini, is also a part of the nonprofit, so it's under NATIFS also. And I also founded the Sous Chef in 2014, done a lot of work there. And I'm from Pine Ridge, South Dakota. I'm enrolled with the Oglala Lakota.
So I saw you out in Palm Springs here a couple of weeks ago, and yeah. It was good to see you. You got an award from the Association of Tribal Archives, Libraries, and Museums, otherwise known as ATOM. Can you tell us a little bit about what that award was?
Yeah, I mean, it's a Trailblazer Awards. Just for a lot of the work that we've been doing of really just trying to bring Indigenous food ways into a larger conversation, just trying to be role models of what we can do. And I feel very lucky that we get this kind of attention because it just helps us broaden our platform to be able to have a louder voice. Just been a lot of nods to this work, I should say, you know, but again, for me, like this work was never about myself personally. It's great that I get these awards. I feel like it just helps open up the doors for other people. All I want to do is just, you know, leave this world a better place down the road.
Why don't you tell what's next for Natives?
Well, I'm working on a new restaurant concept that would open up in Minnesota this next year in Minneapolis. And so that if it works out, that brings around a new restaurant concept for people to try out. So something a little bit different, a little bit lower price point than Awamini. I think it'll be a lot of fun. But we're also just moving forward with creating institutional food support, meaning the formats that schools and hospitals utilize so that we can give them options. So a lot of our schools and hospitals, of course, just utilize a lot of these food products from Sysco's and Aramark's and US Foods and these kinds of big box trucks, you know, Sodexo's and stuff like that. And so we want to start creating healthy Indigenous foods, making sure that we're making recipes with Indigenous ingredients that we purchase from tribal communities or individuals or entities, whatever it might be. So we're just trying to figure out ways to get food out there, which is why we're moving into this institutional food support of making foods for schools and hospitals and penitentiaries or whoever else is using large format food service. At the same time, just creating a way to distribute these products and move them around, whether it's in retail form or wholesale form, because we can move big bags of stuff around too. And our goal is to start to work with all the tribes so we can eventually start sending this food out all across the state. And then that goal is to just continue to grow that. And then we'll probably start doing that same program up in Montana. The restaurant here in Minnesota is part of the nonprofit because we use that for primarily job creation, because we have 100 employees at Awamini and about 70% of our staff identifies as Indigenous, which is a pretty big number for a city like Minneapolis. And to set up a lot of the same models that we built here with the Indigenous Food Lab, and we're able to move nearly $1 million a year directly to Indigenous food producers because of our purchasing power. So like we have a lot of fun things that we're just trying to create and grow. And, you know, we're just open because we want to help other people create concepts. We can help tribes create Indigenous food service concepts for their casinos and communities. You know, we can always be here to train and develop anybody who wants to move into food production, and whether it's like a community center or a museum, and it can be hard. So we just want to try to figure out ways to get, you know, food product directly into communities like that, especially, you know, in places like where I grew up on Pine Ridge, where we just have, you know, we're dotted with a few gas stations, or nowadays there's a couple of fast food restaurants, but, you know, there's not a lot of healthy nutritional food access, especially in the form of native foods. There's a big book that comes out next year. So my second cookbook will be out next year. I did that with Kate Nelson here in Minnesota, who's a native journalist and writer. Also, Kristen Donnelly, who lives out east. But we put together this massive book that'll be basically focused on Turtle Island. So it looks at North America, Mexico through Alaska, and all of the Indigenous diversity that's out there, but doing it through a cookbook form.
That's awesome. Wow, man. Keep it up, and hope to see you around here soon.
Absolutely. Well, appreciate that.
That's all for this week's episode. Join us next time for more voices and stories that inform, uplift, and shape our communities, right here on Minnesota Native News. Minnesota Native News is produced by AMPERS, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, made possible by funding from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and the citizens of Minnesota.
You can find more at minnesotanativenews.org. It is 6:36. Good morning. It is the Monday morning show here on KAXE. I'm Jennifer Barr. Thanks so much for tuning in. Coming up just after 7 o'clock, Megan Buffington has a special feature for the Up North Report, North Star Students. It's a new feature we are doing, and you can find that story about Bemidji Swimmer at KAXE.org. Support for KAXE comes from the Grand Rapids Farmers Market, now offering their winter market once a month with pickup at the Mesabi Trailhead building inside the Itasca County Fairgrounds. The next pickup date is Saturday, November 22nd from 1 to 2 p.m. Pre-orders are required, with more info at grfarmersmarket.org. Support also comes from Paul Bunyan Communications, offering technology for businesses, including cloud solutions, cybersecurity services, network management, and more, all with local customer service and support. Paul Bunyan Communications, Northern Minnesota's local broadband cooperative. Weather for today, a mix of clouds and sun, highs near 33, winds from the west 5 to 10, chance of flurries tonight, lows in the 20s, south winds up to 20 miles per hour. And tomorrow, partly to mostly sunny, a bit warmer with highs 41 to 46, but blustery northwest winds. Looking ahead to Wednesday, sunny with highs in the low 40s. Up next, we're going to hear from Laura Erickson speaking for the birds.
Most of the changes in bird populations during my lifetime have been due to the massive changes humans have brought to the earth in terms of habitat, air and water quality, climate, pesticides, and the introduction of domesticated and wild but invasive species in vulnerable areas. But the enormous change in one species' range is pretty much universally accepted as simply a bizarre range expansion that may have had nothing to do with humans. The western cattle egret used to be found nowhere on the planet except Africa, southern Portugal, and southern Spain. Scientists believe that in the late 1800s, some plucky individuals crossed the Atlantic Ocean from Africa's west coast to South America. The first records of cattle egrets on the continent were in Suriname in 1877 and in Guyana in 1911. The species quickly became well established, but it took until 1950 for someone to find and report a nest. That first breeding record in the Americas was in Guyana. The first report in the United States was in Florida in 1941, and the first nesting report was 2 years later. At that point, the species rapidly expanded. Cattle egrets are not depicted in the first edition of the Peterson Guide from 1934, nor the one I started with, the second edition from 1947. Had I only had the Peterson Guide when I started birding, I'd have been mystified when Russ and I took a trip to South Carolina and Georgia in 1976. Cattle egrets were all over the place. Fortunately, my trusty Golden Guide was the one I always used. The map in that book, published in 1966, showed it right where we were. I saw my first cattle egrets in Wisconsin at the Nine Springs Natural Area near Madison in May 1978. I was shocked to see my first Minnesota one all the way up in Grand Marais on October 30, 1982. There are nesting records in western Minnesota from 1971 through 1992, but no one has found a nest anywhere in the state since then. Cattle egrets nest in heronries with other species. I got to enjoy them up close and personal at the Wacotahatchee Wetlands in Delray Beach, Florida, when I was on a wonderful birding tour there with Rafael Galvez in April in both 2023 and 2024. Now I've seen western cattle egrets in a total of 9 countries outside the United States and in 12 states, including Hawaii. The cattle egrets I saw in Hawaii were western cattle egrets intentionally introduced by humans. The Asian version, once considered the same species but now called the eastern cattle egret, has been reported in the Midway Atoll and the Aleutian Islands and may well have appeared in Hawaii, though it would be hard to tell except in breeding plumage. The eastern species' nuptial plumes are a much richer, darker buffy orange. Cattle egrets of both forms are the most terrestrial members of the heron family, taking their name from their habit of associating with large mammals. People, of course, would focus on them hanging out with cattle, but they're just as happy with bison, camels, ostriches, rhinos, and tortoises. Some people used to think cattle egrets pick ticks off the large mammals, but they feed on little critters stirred up by heavy hooves. They do sometimes sit on the backs of large animals, but that may simply give them a broader view of the area. Western cattle egrets frequently fly over long distances over open water. We saw several in flight over the Atlantic on my boat trip to the Dry Tortugas this spring, and a small group seemed well settled on Garden Key. Some were in breeding plumage. But I never saw a cattle egret in St. Louis County until just last week on October 28th, a short ways from Duluth on the Ryan Road north of Highway 61. That single individual was reported by Petter Svingen and Sue Barton on October 26th, and lots of birders have had a chance to see it. It stuck around for at least a week. Cattle egrets often follow farmers' tractors, which stir up insects, frogs, and other small animals, so I shouldn't have been surprised that this lovely visitor wasn't fazed in the least by me taking a bazillion photos out my car window. I was thrilled to see it, but hope it wasn't disappointed that my car didn't stir up any lunch for it. I'm hopeful that before the weather gets bad, it'll head to a more congenial climate. I'm Laura Erickson, speaking for the birds.
Find more at lauraerickson.com. It's the Monday Morning Show here on People Powered KAXE. Thanks so much for tuning in. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up at 7:20, it's Events Up North. Steve Noy and I will take a closer look at many things that are happening throughout the region this week. You can also find that list at our website, kaxe.org. Support comes from the Timberlake Restaurant in Grand Rapids, featuring Martini Monday each week from 5 to 8. More information at timberlakelodgehotel.com. We also thank the First State Bank of Big Fork, with branches in Big Fork and Kellyer, offering tools for managing money on any mobile device. Hometown banking at its best since 1912. FSBBigFork.com, member FDIC. Weather for today, a mix of clouds and sun, highs near 33. West winds 5 to 10. Chance of flurries tonight with lows in the 20s, and tomorrow partly to mostly sunny, highs 41 to 46.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, supporting books, radio, podcasts, film, television, theater, and more to bridge science and the humanities. From Eric and Wendy Schmidt, through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all, on the web at theschmidt.org. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Leila Faudel. Good morning. It's been almost 2 weeks since Hurricane Melissa, a Category 5 storm, slammed into Jamaica. Insurance companies expect the damage to top $4 billion. NPR's Ader Peralta has been traveling the island, and he joins us now from Montego Bay. Good morning, Ader.
Hey, good morning, Leila.
So let's start with what you're seeing. How's the recovery going?
I mean, look, we've driven for hours crisscrossing the most affected areas. One good thing is that the government has cleared the roads, so aid and goods can move freely. And a lot of regular Jamaicans have loaded their cars with goods, and they're handing out aid along the road. In the sky, we've seen the U.S. military flying Chinooks, those big two-propeller helicopters, and they're delivering aid. But we've also noticed power lines are still down, and we've seen few crews trying to fix them. A lot of people don't have water, don't have food. So you see them at rivers bathing. I talked to Sarah and Delano Chambers. They were on the side of the road asking for aid.
And so you just have to write a sign.
You want water and food.
Water and food and everything.
You know, and right now they have no jobs, their homes are destroyed, they're sleeping outside, and the only thing they feel that they can do is hold up a sign asking for aid.
Wow. And tell us a little bit more about the damage, the physical damage you've been seeing.
In Western Jamaica, the damage is apocalyptic. I mean, we've seen nearly 200-year-old stone churches turn to rubble. Some small villages are just piles of wood. One of the stunning things from this storm is what it did to the mountains. They used to be lush and green, and now they are gray. We have seen miles of trees toppled and whole forests stripped of their leaves. In a town called Bluefields, I met Glenwick Clark, who's a beekeeper, and he says even the bees right now can't find any food in the wild, so they're venturing into people's homes.
They're really looking for food because they're at the brink of starvation. And it's not just the bees, you're talking about the butterfly, you're talking about the doctor birds. All of them are in danger of dying.
Wow.
So this storm has affected everything, from the humans to churches, right down to the bees. And when farmers plant again, Clark is worried that there may not be enough pollinators. Already the government says that most crops in what is the breadbasket of Jamaica have been totally wiped out.
Wow. Okay, so let's talk about the future then. What's the government saying? What are people planning?
You know, I've been focused on that question in my reporting, and scientists say that it's clear that this type of storm, with a rapid intensification and off-the-charts wind speeds, is made possible by climate change. And nearly everyone I've talked to here, from civilians to politicians, say that in order to keep living here, things have to change. And there's one fascinating example. If you look across the hardest hit areas, what you find is that some houses did survive. It was those that were built of steel and concrete. And interestingly, they were built with what Jamaicans call a slab, and that's a concrete roof. One lady whose house did survive said she wanted a traditional wood roof because she liked to hear the rainfall. But now she's happy that her husband insisted on a slab. I spoke to a climate change chief for the government here. And he said, this is not some hands up, we don't know what to do moment. He said, we have the data, we know what to do to make Jamaica more resilient. We just need the political will and the money to do that. Of course, those two things are very complicated.
NPR's Ader Peralta reporting from Montego Bay, Jamaica. Thank you, Ader.
Thank you, Layla.
This is NPR News.
It is 6:49. Thanks for listening to People Powered KAXC and the Monday Morning Show. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up just after 7 o'clock, a special edition of the Up North Report. We're going to meet our first North Star student. And coming up at 7:20, it's Events Up North. We'll take a closer look at what's happening throughout the region, and then we'll have best wishes. If you have birthday or anniversary greetings to share, text in 218-326-1234. At 8:45 this morning, a bright spot, we're going to learn more about United Way of 1000 Lakes and the volunteer opportunities that they have available. Coming up at 9 o'clock, Andrew DeZingle is your host for Headwaters. It's Monday, which means a request line. At 10:30, we play a set of music based on your song suggestions. Andrew's theme today, songs about food. Text those in 218-326-1234. You can also answer our question of the week. We want to hear about the things you made in home ec and or shop class. Text us all about it, 218-326-1234. Taking a look at our temperatures, we are in the low to mid 20s throughout the region. 26 in Brainerd, the warm spot. 22 in Hibbing is our cool spot. You can learn about the Civic Pledge for a Better Minnesota with Majority in the Middle. That's this Thursday, 10:30 to 11:30 a.m. at Rapids Brewing Company in Grand Rapids. The pledge affirms a commitment to reject political violence and foster civic trust. You will also learn how small actions can lead to meaningful change. There is more news ahead from National Public Radio's Morning Edition. We'll hear about a veteran from Iwo Jima, also the 50th anniversary of the wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald.
NPR News, I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. The Marine Corps was founded 250 years ago today. Colorado Public Radio's Benta Berkland met a veteran who witnessed a famous moment in Marine history.
In 1945, the tiny Pacific island of Iwo Jima was critical in the Allies' fight against Japan.
When this flag drops, our landing craft will head for the beach.
This Navy documentary recounts the battle. Military leaders thought it would be a quick victory, but it stretched for a grueling 36 days. Nearly 7,000 Marines were killed, and 20,000 more were wounded. The deadliest battle in Marine Corps history. Jim Blaine survived.
When they raised that flag, we didn't know it was going to become as famous as it was, but I understand why it did.
Now 100 years old, Blaine lives in Denver.
Some of the guys went into tears, and I got choked up over it myself.
Blaine was just 20 years old when he saw the six Marines together push the flagpole up on the summit of Mount Suribachi. Three of the six were killed before Iwo Jima fell about a month later. 20,000 Japanese soldiers died trying to hold the island.
I did what I had to do, is to try to kill more Japanese people. And my buddies and I did it, whether we liked it or not.
At one point, a bullet grazed Blaine's helmet. Later, he was shot through the foot.
I could still walk on it. It got worse later on, but I never seen a doctor until we had finished taking Iwo Jima.
He was awarded a Purple Heart.
The Marine Corps was chosen to finish that war. We did what we were told to do, and we went ahead and finished it up the island. We lost more of our guys, but we did secure the island. The Japanese surrendered.
When I was getting ready to say goodbye to Blaine, I thanked him for his service.
Supposed to say, thank you for my freedom. Say that.
Thank you for my freedom.
There it is.
For NPR News, I'm Benta Berkland in Denver.
The flag raising is famous thanks to a photo. The Edmund Fitzgerald is famous thanks to a song. 50 years ago, the ship sank in Lake Superior with a crew of 29. Here's NPR's Netta Ulaby.
Even decades later, Gordon Lightfoot's ballad rings like a requiem.
The legend lives on from the Chippewa on down of the big lake they call Gitche-Gumee.
The Canadian folk star was horrified by the tragedy. But this wreck was not unique, says author John U. Bacon.
From 1875 to 1975, there were at least 6,000 commercial shipwrecks on the bottom of the Great Lakes. So that is one shipwreck a week, every week for a century.
Bacon's new best-selling book is called The Gales of November, the untold story of the Edmund Fitzgerald.
And it was, in fact, the greatest ship on the Great Lakes when it launched in Detroit in 1958.
Imagine, he says, a freshwater Titanic.
When it went through the Sioux Locks or Detroit or Duluth, people would wait half a day to see this ship come through. It was a rock star.
A rock star at the apex of Great Lakes maritime trade.
Do you find ships like these? Nowhere but on the five great inland seas of America.
That's from a promotional documentary from 1959 by the Lake Carriers Association. Hundreds of ships carried lumber, limestone, copper, and cars to the St. Lawrence Seaway that led to the Atlantic. And they carried iron.
Pellets from taconite ore, concentrated to high-grade feed for blast furnaces.
26,000 tons of those pellets were on the Edmund Fitzgerald. For it to maneuver through the narrow locks that connect Lake Superior with the other Great Lakes, the freighter, says John U. Bacon, had to be skinny.
Only 75 feet wide. That's less than the space from home plate to first base. What's the problem with that? They can't handle rough seas.
Rough seas on the Great Lakes? Remember, Lake Superior is the size of Austria. And Bacon says freshwater waves do not have salt to weigh them down, so they get huge and spiky, even more treacherous than oceans.
Now, do you realize what the conditions are out there?
That's an archival recording from when the Coast Guard tried to rescue the Edmund Fitzgerald from a storm with winds around 100 miles an hour.
That's hurricane, and you've got 60 feet of water going on top of you. Each wave weighs about the same as two train engines, and that's happening every 4 to 8 seconds. It has to take a toll.
The last words of the captain, Ernest McSorley, were, "We're holding our own," according to the 1975 Coast Guard recording.
He said he was holding his own. The last time I talked with him, he said he was holding his own.
This did not feel like a distant tragedy to musician Gordon Lightfoot, says John U. Bacon. He knew those waters well.
Gordon Lightfoot was a great sailor. He did the Port Huron to Mackinac Island race. That's a 3-day race on Lake Huron.
And Lightfoot was disappointed by the U.S. media's coverage of the disaster. As he told NPR in 2015, 8 years before he died.
Saw an article in Newsweek magazine. I said, God, I said, this is short shrift for such a monumental event.
Lightfoot was very anxious about writing the song. He did not want to be seen as exploiting a tragedy. But a few months later, while recording an album, he kept fiddling with the song on breaks. Eventually, everyone in the studio convinced him to let them try it on tape. Their first take is what you hear on the album.
The captain wired in, he had water coming in, and the good ship and crew was in peril. And later that night, when his lights went out of sight, came the wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald.
It has no hook. Got no guitar solo. It's just 28 two-line stanzas that repeat throughout 6.5 minutes. It never should have worked.
It did. The song hit number 2 on the Billboard charts right after Rod Stewart's Tonight's the Night.
Does anyone know where the love of God goes when the waves turn the minutes to hours?
Today, Lightfoot's song is beloved by the families of the sailors who died. The singer became close to those families. He attended their reunions, and he supported scholarships at the Great Lakes Maritime Academy. The disaster Gordon Lightfoot memorialized, says Bacon, helped reform Great Lakes safety standards in shipping.
6,000 commercial shipwrecks from 1875 to 1975. Since November 10th, 1975, zero. Not one. And I guarantee you the families I've talked to are very aware of this fact.
All that remains is the faces and names of the wives and the sons and the daughters, now also granddaughters and great-grandsons. They will gather today as the bell rings 29 times. Some have tattoos that bear the final words of the Edmund Fitzgerald's captain. We are holding our own. Netta Ulaby, NPR News.
Lake Huron rolls.
superior scenes in the rooms of her ice water mansion.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
It is a minute before 7 o'clock. Thank you for listening to the Monday Morning Show on 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley, Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker, we're people-powered radio in northern Minnesota. You can join us at KAXE.org. Good morning. I'm Jennifer Barr with Steve Noy.
Good morning. We are looking for your home ec and shop class projects. You can text us at 218-326-1234 and answer our question of the week. Tell us about those projects, your home economics class or your shop class when you were in school. Let us know. Tell us some stories.
Yeah, we'll be sharing more of those as we go along throughout our morning. And coming up in just a few moments, it's the Up North Report.